This is the First Time Podcast.
Part reality series.
Part writer's masterclass. It's a podcast about the first time
you publish a book.
I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to The First Time.
Also, Kate Mildenhall is with me today on the First Time Podcast.
It's just so exciting to join you from my wardrobe. Let's just make a real note that I'm in the wardrobe today.
Okay, so today is something we've been planning for a long time. We are doing a spoiler-riddled deep dive into The Mother Fault.
I'm so excited about talking about the spoilers because I so very rarely have been able to talk about them yet.
You never get the chance, do you? But we'll start by doing a bit of scene setting. What is The Mother Fault about?
Big first question, Catherine Collette. The Mother Fault's about lots of things. It is about a near future Australia. So it looks at surveillance. It looks at ideas of power. It's about motherhood. It's about Mim, who is a mum who's been stuck at home with her kids and she is over it. And when her husband goes missing, she has to work out what she's going to do to keep her kids safe and to try and find him. It's about geology. It's about desire.
Okay.
Look at me. I'm like, oh my God, there's so many things.
Okay. Ooh, I've got just a couple of the questions I reckon you get asked all the time. So we'll do these. Where did the original seed of the idea come from?
So original seed I wrote down on a document that said, do not open this till skylarking is finished. And it was woman on boat with kids leaving Australia. That was the idea. And I realised I've just done this. I just last night did a gig with a local poetry group. And I realised that I've read poetry with them before. And I wrote this very, you know, hopeless kind of funny sonnet about Kevin Rudd having to kind of sneak his elderly parents out of Australia on a boat. And that was, you know, that was about this time. So I was thinking about all this stuff and I was shitty about asylum seeker policy in this country. And I was also deep in that bit where I reckon Etta was at kinder. Maybe still. Maybe Gracie was just in that process of starting school. So I was like deep in children, way deep in children. And I was caught up in this idea that I, like some of the women I was reading about, would risk my life to protect my kids and do outrageous, terrible things to keep them safe. At the same time that I was, you know, at that point in time, also having to go into my room and close the door and scream quietly into the pillow because I was so frustrated and over it and resentful that my partner got to go to work and every day and step out of it and that I didn't. So it was those two ideas clashing up against each other and me wondering, well, how do you hold those two thoughts together? That's where it came from.
I feel like that sense of motherhood feels particularly, I mean, people talk about the prescience of the government intervention and social control within this book, but you could also say it of the motherhood aspect as well within a pandemic living.
Oh my God.
But maybe that's.
Have we ever felt as over it? It's like having, I said it to someone the other day, it's like being back in that phase where you have, you know, often people have a toddler and a baby and you're like, okay, today I'll spend an hour at the park, you know, and then we'll get home. Like it's back to that kind of micromanagement of keeping your children amused. Whew, yeah. I feel like people are really feeling the motherhood part.
Well, you can certainly see, I mean, that original seed is that's the book, isn't it? It the echo is so strong. I'm interested in the world that you created. There's a lot of government intervention. There's a lot of technology, social control. Where did you start? How did you begin to build that world?
So I started, I reckon, I'd love to go back and actually see where my Google searching started, but I think when I was doing surveillance, I started with, I still don't know if I'm pronouncing it right, Xinjiang province in in China, which is like the most surveilled, particularly the Uyghur people there, most surveilled population on earth at this point in time, and just like fell down a Google hole of reading about that and about people's stories. And I still remember this article where it was, you know, people who were in that part of China talking to people who were outside, and they knew that they were being recorded, so they would hold up handwritten signs to each other in their video calls, so that they, because they didn't think that the, you know, the writing could be picked up, the handwriting, so they would, you know, hold up signs and say, please don't say anything about, you know, or I love you, mum, or whatever. And so that kind of idea of thinking, oh my gosh, what does constant surveillance look like? And I've read Anna Funder again, and, you know, looking at Stasi kind of intervention and what happens to a population when they're under complete kind of control like that. But
it's so interesting that you pick surveillance though, isn't it? Like that is the starting point, because there are really multiple, now we're in a pandemic, that, you know, that's a way in which
exactly
people's lives are curtailed.
And also, you know, at the start, it was so hard to try and work out the scenario and the context, because I kept on, my question to myself always was, is this plausible? You know, is this plausible? Is this plausible? But also, how do I make a reader come with me and believe that this is, that there are enough push factors and pull factors for her to make this move? So because it was kind of outside of my zone, not that I have much experience, I've written one like historical fiction novel, but in terms of all my reading, I know that if there's that slight break where you're like, oh shit, I don't buy this, you know, the whole novel's gone. You can't go with it. So I knew that it had to be plausible, and I knew I had to build up this scenario at the start. And I tried various different things and came up in the end with this kind of three-pronged terror attack, which is the, you know, the MCG and the banks, and then this stealing a virus. But it's very small. Like, we never see that. It's in one paragraph. But you know, because I couldn't fathom a time when Australians, the type of society we live in, would hand over control so much. So that's what's been so surreal to me watching this year, and how, in fact, and some of the commentary I've been reading, which is, you know, in fact, that whole idea of us being this kind of larrikin post-convict state who doesn't trust the cops or whatever, that's bullshit. We do. We're absolutely compliant, and there's nothing wrong with that. You know, like, I also think that the question, or the thing I was trying to raise, especially like with that epigraph about, you know, we didn't read the terms and conditions, is just to pay attention to where power is, you know, that you don't have to necessarily revolt against it. You just need to be aware of where it's sitting, I think.
Yeah, the power, it's interesting because a lot, I'll make a generalisation, I have the sense that speculative or science fiction writers are very interested, or can be very interested, in the technologies and the world can look like. But it sounds like to you needed to have a world that was a certain way, and so you unwind to get to that world.
Yeah. And but also, you know me, I'm not across science fiction or spec fiction. Like, I hadn't read the canon. I felt deeply intimidated that I didn't know what I was writing into, and also that I'm not the most tech savvy, up to date. I mean, one of the things that I realized when I was reading is that so much of the tech is already miles ahead, but it hasn't filtered out to the general population. So there's things in there that people might say, oh yeah, that's old tech, or that's already been done in lots of places. But then that idea of that kind of great digital divide, that it hasn't got out to everyone else, or like there's people like my darling husband who does not use social media or any of those things. So I had to really be careful about what I was going to put in and leave out in that kind of world building. But I also wanted, I really needed Mim to have grown up in a world that felt much more familiar to me. So in terms of the timeline, it's 10 years, 15 years in the future, if everything had gone to shit 5 years ago, so that, you know, so that she's still growing up. She's probably, you know, I had her in my head a bit older than what I am, but that she, she grew up before all this went down, in that kind of time that we've grown up, which is that it's all just accelerated so fast.
What were the most significant moments in building the world? Were there things that, like, real turning points in,
I think,
what shaped that?
I think one of the things was that I was so terrified about it and I really didn't know how to do it. And that's when I started the mentorship with Charlotte, like really at the point where I was like, I don't know what this book is, and there's no genre at that stage. I wasn't reading a lot of stuff that fitted in. There's a lot more stuff now that was that kind of near future, but very based in the realist kind of tradition. And she was great. She said, go back and read Never Let Me Go, Isiguro. And what's the other one?
They made that into a movie, that book.
Yeah.
Never Let Me Go.
Yeah, and I went back then to things like Clade, James Bradley's Clade, and tried to get a sense of that presentness. I wanted to feel like it was just slightly pushed forward. And so all of those books kind of helped me do that, kind of reading them. And then, you know, it came out later, but things like Black Mirror, you know, I got into the cycle of just watching that and trying to watch on a really technical level. Like, I love that stuff that you do when you're studying humor and you're listening to podcasts about how they do that. Like, I was watching films to go, how exactly did that thing happen? Did they make that moment of technology or social control or whatever? How did they do that? So those kinds of moments were really good. And knowing that I was going to use geology as the big kind of metaphor in it was really helpful, because then I knew that I wanted to write about the climate crisis, but I didn't want that at the foreground of what was happening and what she was concerned about. But I could kind of underwrite it, if that makes sense, because of the geology metaphor.
Yeah, I'm interested. I actually have the geology metaphor down there. Talk to us about that.
So I got...
Why was that?
I think originally it came in from a plot line from that kind of fracking plot line. And I wanted them to be involved in mining. I wanted to talk about resource extraction, but I wanted it to be complex or nuanced in that way that they worked in the industry and they understood the way the industry worked. And potentially, this is Mim and her husband, Ben, were also working on that sustainable aspect of the industry. Like, how do we make mining sustainable, because it's complicated. It's really complicated on multiple levels. So it came in then, and then it was just so abundantly fun to play with. It was also because I was originally, the book was called Borderless, and I spent a long, long time looking at the movement of tectonic plates and the fact that Australia is actually moving towards Indonesia, and, you know, what does place mean? And are we connected more to place or more to family, or where is our community? All that kind of stuff. They were the questions I was asking. And because I was reading so much literature and stories of asylum seekers and stuff at that time, this was really early on when it was kind of a different book. So it was also that I got kind of obsessed with deep time and tectonics and all this kind of stuff. And then I read John McPhee's Annals of the Former World. I didn't read the whole thing first. I saw one essay. I kind of came across it in my Google holes. And then I bought his book, which is this massive book that's like it's basically a biography of the landscape of the United States, if that makes sense, like how it formed. And because he's just this sensational journalist, I think he's actually mostly a sports journalist, he just writes it in this incredible way. I could not put it down. Like, it's so ridiculous to talk about it like this, but it was extraordinary. And so I was also like, this understanding, and someone had said to me really on that there's a group of, you know, there's people in the earth sciences who are really, they're not climate change deniers, but they have a bigger sense about it because of their understanding.
The earth sciences, like, are one of the most, I had to take some earth sciences subjects. They are a fascinating group.
Well, they think differently. Like, and that's what I had
just
to get.
The scale of time.
The scale of time.
Massive.
And the scale of time, because it's all about also Mim's life, and that there are elements of our life that then are interrupted or that we might let go. And this idea of strata, which I got really into, of building that life is like kind of strata in rock. And so there's these different parts that we build upon each other. And if we forget what those previous parts are, or if we choose not to acknowledge them, you know, the whole thing falls apart. So that was in my head. And then I went and sat in on these first year geology lectures just to try and make my head think about deep time, yeah, or what you would consider.
It's sort of strangely apt for a thriller too, in terms of personality types, because a lot of geologists, well, certainly where I studied, were very into like extreme caving and hardcore mountain climbing, and the research would be about being in Antarctica and unintuitively extreme.
Connected to land, and that connected to land, and also, like, I don't know enough people in geology to make this extreme generalization, but I liked that, you know, I wrote thousands and thousands and thousands of words of Mim and Ben's backstory, like that it's all there, how they met, like their marriage, their like it's all there, their first date, I've got it all. So I liked that they met that way and that was their connection. But I also needed to make her a bit of a loner. So she doesn't like the school mums. She doesn't, you know, engage in that other kind of stuff. And also that she has lost in that 10 years when she has been not working, she's lost her work community. Yeah. And that was really important as a plot point, because I needed, and I think I've said this, people might have heard me say this, but whenever I asked myself the what would I do in this situation, what would I do if I, you know, had no money, like how would I get cash, or what would I do if I had to run and how would I hide, etc., the answer I kept coming up to was I would go to my girlfriends and they would help me. You know, they would give me all the money, yeah, they would protect me, hide me, kill someone if they really needed to. And so I needed for that not to be an option for her as a plot point.
To keep going on this geology theme, geology and motherhood. I mean, the book is called The Mother Fault. Did you see a relationship between those two things?
Well, I think that idea of the deep time, you know, that moment, I don't know if you felt this, I'm assuming you felt something like this, but when you just think like this is endless, like the night's never going to end when you've got a really little baby, like time has lost all meaning. It was the first time in my life where time really became completely amorphous and I didn't understand it. And also that idea when people say to you, you know, this too shall pass, like this is a phase, and just never believing them. Like this time is extended into this foreverness. And yet thinking, well, if you had understood more that like your time on the planet is like this big, it's microscopic, would that make a difference to the, and you know, it doesn't to Mim because she's so deep in it, you know, and it doesn't. But that's where I was really interested in that idea. And the fault line stuff was just like a gift in thinking about how those kinds of fractures, and I read so much about fractures and slips. Like I used to just make lists of vocab from geology books, or you know, just for all those kinds of ideas, the way that kind of tiny fractures can start and then, you know, they turn into these like massive fault lines and everything, you know, goes to shit around it. That's kind of, it's so disruptive, eruptive, the act of having a child to your life. It kind of just played into it so beautifully.
And so in terms of making lists of language, did that then become something you used a lot in the way that Mim sees the world?
It was helpful. I think it was just helpful in that process stuff. You know, you and I have talked lots about that journaling that I did, and it was just, yeah, it was trying to get myself into the headspace. And it was also when I wrote this the first time, I really thought of it as holding text. Like I really thought I was trying to write a much more plotty book, and I wasn't interested in beautiful language, and I was just going to write it as spare as I could just to get it down. And then, you know, my theory being that then I would go back and I would make it all beautiful. And I never really did do that. I mean, I hope some of the language is beautiful, but I did try and keep it very spare. And that meant that I had to make individual words work much harder. And so I really did want this enormous new kind of vocab that I hadn't played with before about landscape. And it's interesting because I'm doing the same thing right now for the new book on butchery. You know, like I've got lists of like verbs and stuff to do with butchery just because it, you know, it's a theme in the book and it just helps. I just find that it really helps my writing then.
Hmm. Okay, let's talk about Ben.
Yes.
Ben is Mim's husband.
Yep.
Hugely key, central part to the story. At the same time, almost entirely absent.
Entirely absent.
So how, I mean, that's a conscious decision, isn't
yeah.
it? I mean, you said you've written the entire backstory, but we learn very little of that yeah. backstory, don't we?
Yeah. And it was when I realised that that's what the plot, how it was going to roll, which I realised pretty early, I was like, oh, how do you build an entire book around a character who's not there?
It's a tension, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like, and is he good? Is he not good?
Exactly. And at different times, you know, like when I really first started, he had been, you know, he had disappeared not of his own volition at all. You know, it was complete kind of accident. And I read a lot of stuff on disappearances and the kind of state tactic of disappearances as a form of terror against its citizens and stuff like that. But also then, you know, that the way that it impacted Mim, you know, like the not knowing of where he was, is also such a pull and such a driver for her. Like it, you know, if she knew where he was and he was just in trouble, would she have gone to get him? You know, the thing of also her having to solve the mystery of where he is was a very strong push. And I really wanted Ben, she relies on Ben and she, you know, there's still a lot of love there. Tony Jordan, brilliant Tony Jordan, said very early on to me when I was working with her a little bit on the ideas for the book. And she said, yeah, but Kate, if she's so unhappy, why hasn't she left before the book begins? And it was the most useful question. You know, sometimes people just ask you a question about your book or the content.
Well, that is a fundamental. Isn't
yeah.
it? That's one of
and
those
like,
things that then becomes
shit,
implausible.
Yes.
Why is she hates him but she's chasing him?
Yeah.
But yeah. That's...
And so I knew that I had to make it both that there was – that the reader could see that there was this great depth of love there, or and there had been. Also that she, because of her experience, which is hinted at of kind of postnatal anxiety or depression, that she feels like she needs him to be able to both look after the children and for them to be okay, for her to be okay. She's really become quite dependent on that. And I think like lots of people can relate to that idea, even just, you know, in that weird 1 week or 2 weeks or whatever you're lucky enough to get if your partner's home with you and then they go back to work and you're with this newborn child and you're like, but I don't even know what to do. So it was kind of that, you know, pulling out that idea. And also this idea that Ben gets to make a political and ethical and moral kind of stance on what he believes in. And whether or not Mim would have done that or could have done that, she never got the chance because, as she says, you know, she was at school pickup. So that's the other tension. And I don't think, like, I don't mean to condemn Ben in the book because I also don't have a position on it. Like, I think there's many people who make outrageously big sacrifices for the you know, things that they believe in. And I don't at all think that's a bad thing. But just the tension in this particular relationship was so good to explore that.
So we have Ben, the husband, absent. Mim's obviously trying to find him. But along the way, she meets up with and is aided by Nick, the former boyfriend.
Nick, the former boyfriend.
The former boyfriend.
Hasn't Nick caused a stir?
I feel like the moments of greyness, so where someone has, because it's very easy to, well, it's not easy, but if someone is feeling one thing, then that's such a more straightforward proposition as a writer. But here you have her pursuing husband, having sex with Nick on a boat. Mm-hmm. Is that a hard thing to balance, and how do you do it? This idea of I am chasing a person that I love whilst having sex with another.
Yeah. Ridiculously hard to do. And I don't think I had it right. You know, why I think, you know, it does work now is that I get these responses from people, like some of whom are like, oh, you know, Nick's great, sex is great. Felt like I had to have a cigarette after reading that chapter. And then other people, like in a book club the other night, someone was like, oh, you know, just outraged, completely morally outraged that she would do that. So I knew that it would be divisive. I also, the first couple of times that I wrote it, it wasn't working. I didn't get that balance right. So I know how fine the balance is. And I was deeply kind of hurt by some of those responses, which just said it was kind of like, you know, dirty, gratuitous, you know, kind of stuff. And I didn't want that. So I worked really hard. I wanted Nick to be, I think that's actually where I made the change to him being an ex-boyfriend or someone from her past, because I needed it to be multi-layered in that way, that it was also about her seeing her younger self and recognizing in Nick that this is the person I used to be and I still am. And, you know, and there's a strength and a life and desire in that. So that was important. I also thought a lot and like tried to read and thought about movies, lots of those war movies where people in times of great trauma are still caught up. And you know that because, you know, people have babies. That's how we know, you know, in times of great trauma, that's still that kind of desire for closeness and connection. And for her, this chance of being seen for herself again is so huge. Also, as a narrative device, you know, unresolved sexual tension is my absolute go-to. It was, you know, my sister and I laugh about this because she did a whole speech about it at my wedding. Like, it fueled me through my 10 years. It's the storyline I look for. I realize I will write it again and again. And
what do you mean when you say unresolved sexual, as in the build, or that a rising sexual tension is cut short and picked back up?
I think the build is so effective. Yeah. So the build makes a person keep turning the pages. And then, you know, the beauty of being able to play with it in this book is because then it happens mid-book, like, and it's resolved, but then you're like, oh God, what have we done now? You know, and then you've got to kind of unresolve it or keep it going. So I think that, you know, I enjoyed writing that. I think it's fun. I think it adds to this idea of what I knew I was always going to get to, which I kind of did in Skylarking too, which makes me think like I'm a one trick pony. But you know, the choice is neither of the men. That's the point.
Well, I was going to ask about the parallel with Skylarking in terms of threesome is too strong a word, but.
Oh. I know.
There are three kind of people in not necessarily in the bed, but on the table.
Yeah. You know? But that's and
in very different ways.
In very different ways. But it's just such a good tension to work with, I find. Like I think I am gonna have to make sure that I don't keep getting stuck on it. And I think there's other ways to work with those kinds of tensions. But certainly for me, it's always about choosing these different.
It's very satisfying as a reader, like especially the arc of a woman. I mean, you wouldn't do it every single novel, but that the she doesn't choose in both instances. They don't choose the man.
They don't choose the man. And I think, you know, I wrote about this week and in the most hilarious experience, because it was my first instance of seeing the trolls come out on Twitter about my, you know, self-engrossed narcissism as a woman who can't be fulfilled as a mother. But you know, and the reason that I wrote that article about
people
motherhood
with about what, three followers?
Yeah, exactly. But
do
like,
they set up an account just to do
maybe
this?
They is do. That, probably they do. But, you know, motherhood, sex, all of that stuff, like this idea that you could have a woman in her early 40s who is in the constant act of looking after her kids. She's not away on a conference, or she's not, you know, she hasn't split up and gone on a retreat or something. She is in the act of looking after her kids. She's in kind of trauma and all the rest of it. And yet she's got, you know, this old flame who's got sexier as he grows up, because bloody hell, that's what men do. And isn't that unfortunate for the rest of us? But with his boat and being all, you know, I'll look after you, with this simmering sexual tension, and that like, yes, well, that can happen. That can be something that we would normally give every single one of our male heroes in films. And that was this interesting thing that I was asked by a male author about this, you know, mother heroes and why we find it difficult to see them in this sexual light. And I suppose what I came up with is because we don't let mums, you know, be sexual in that way. So that was also me being stubborn and, you know.
Well, maternal is not traditionally a super sexy kind of.
No, exactly.
Concept,
Madonna whore complex. That's not. It's the opposite.
The kids are a great, I mean, talking about threesomes as a narrative device to build tension, the kids become a great way of putting sort of obstacles in Mim's way, don't
they? So many
obstacles. That must have been a lot of fun and so true to life.
Oh, like, so much fun. So much fun. And the woman who was running the session I was in last night doesn't have children, and she was saying, oh, I was so frustrated with them. You know, like, it was so, they would just, you know, they just wouldn't do what they were told, or they got. And I was like, mate, you know, welcome to my daily world. Like, that is the experience of kids.
I just remember lining up for a plane once, and so the plane had been really late and they'd got us to stand up for a really long time. Like, we've been standing there for an hour, and finally they were like, okay, we're going to open the little, you know, take the little ribbony part off and you can walk through. And we had been there so long. Everyone was just like, can we just get on the damn plane? And the couple in front of us was like, must have been like appeared to be a family friend, a woman who was looking after a pretty small child, and that seemed to be the scenario. And the small child turned to the woman and was like, I need to go to the toilet. And you could just, it was that same scenario. Huh. Just this person was like, what?
What?
Now?
No, you can't.
Right this minute?
And that's it. That's exactly it. Like, the impossibility and the timing of those tantrums. And that's why, you know, the opportunity to write a tantrum that seems to come from nowhere, you know, for Sam, but that is also really dangerous. Like, you know, thinking about how frustrated I would get at, you know, tantrums erupting because I was embarrassed, or because it was taking a lot of time and we needed to be somewhere, or because, you know, I was just over it. And this idea that, you know, throwing a tantrum right now can be extraordinarily dangerous, and the tension of then Essie being the only one to calm that down, but also because Nick couldn't just be like, you know, sexy, brilliant, kind of understanding. He's not all that. Like, he's hopelessly flawed as well, that he just had no idea what to do about, you know, Sam tantruming. But the kids were, you know, it was technically challenging to have the kids on every page, like just having to go, okay, where am I going to, like, the kids are going to have to go play outside so they can have this conversation, or the kids are going to have to go on a screen, you know, to do this thing, because that's what we do with our own kids as well. We put them on devices all the time. They were the kinds of things that were stressful.
All right. We just had a minor technical hitch.
Minor technical.
But nice to come back into it. I have one question, very minor question, about that thing of what people read and what you necessarily wanted to write. Someone made the comment that the name Mim is a lot like the name Mum, but slightly different. Was that on purpose? Conscious or not conscious?
No, not conscious. Not conscious. And so
she couldn't have claimed that.
I think for a little bit of time she was May.
Right.
And then I went with Mim. And then hilariously, one of the women that I spoke to, who's extraordinary, she's got geology background and she's written a book called oh my gosh, written in stone about the Great Ocean Road. She draws as well. She does this stratigraphic drawing. And her name is Philomena Manifold, and she goes by Min. Oh, and so it was just like one of those wacky things that you work out. But yeah, no, it's definitely not intentional. Not that smart.
First drafts, very topical for you at the moment.
Yes.
What did the first draft of The Motherfold look like?
Nothing like the last draft. So,
did you start at the start right through?
You know, the first scene, Mim at the kitchen sink, it always started there. But then I kind of wrote 20,000 words, you know, before it. So there's some things that have stayed. There's certainly some exact scenes and exact paragraphs, I would say, but certainly not whole chapters that stayed. And because the context and the plot kept changing, the end, 30 different times maybe ultimately, I've written, you know, kind of the Indonesian section. And that was because it was a plot so propelled by, you know, the ultimate story question is, you know, where is Ben, or will Mim find Ben? But then the plot was so propelled by this kind of road, it's really a road trip kind of a novel, mm-hmm. and then the sailing trip, that I kept on getting to the end and going, well, it could go one of, you know, it's choose your own adventure, right? Could go anyway. And so sitting with that, similarly as starting with the kitchen sink, it always ended, and now because it's spoiler free, because we're doing all the spoilers, we can do it. It always ended with Mim and Essie together, you know, or Mim and the kids. Like that was always that like tonal kind of weight of the last image. But how I got there was vitally different. But one of the things that happened between, say, the first draft and I didn't show anyone. So that's one of the things I did differently. Skylarking was written, you know, like as in writing workshop, really. Everyone had seen all of it. There was nothing sacred about any of it. And this I really held on to. I held back from my editor, and I held back from anyone else for ages and ages. But then that early feedback that I got from readers, Penny Russin did an early read for me. Eventually Charlotte did a manuscript assessment for me, but that was much later. You know, there were kinds of big things in there, like bring out this character needs to be much more Michael, for instance. Michael, the brother, he was mm-hmm. in the first draft. Then I lost him for maybe 3 or 4 drafts. Like I took him completely out. Then I brought him back in again, and really changed his role and that, and brought in Best Life. So there was lots of changes, lots and lots of changes. More, this was the book where I learnt that your first draft may really have very little kind of resemblance to the final product, and that's okay because the process of it is still vitally important to understanding what the final book will be.
It's so hard, that editing process, particularly self-editing, where you have, say, a Michael thread, you pull the whole thing out, but you put it back. You just, those decisions that you make, and you make them for different reasons at points in time, and you kind of I feel like you have to go through that process of taking him out, putting him in. But
I think you do. But I also think,
how do you keep that information? Sometimes I'm like, where is that one?
Yeah, where's the Michael thread? That's doing the journal. That's why that's useful. I still don't have a very good version control. But I think that's, you know, that idea of writers who are towards the mastery end of their craft, who have got, you know, 4, 5, 6, 7 books, and I think one of the things that they do increasingly, I think maybe Charlotte told me this, or, you know, increasingly as they get further up the scale of mastery, they show less and less people their work. And on a technical level, like pragmatically, that's usually because they'd also just be in that loop with their editor, you know. And I think that's because, certainly for me, to be in the creative stage, I have to be really thin-skinned and very porous. Mm. And I'm very suggestible. It's why things like this retreat that I did last week, the amazing word cave again, with Sarah Centilles, is so good, because I'm so susceptible to prompts and generative stuff. And that's why you fall down Google holes and then you write the amazing stuff in, because you've discovered things. And yet the problem with that, the flip side of that is that you're also susceptible, so susceptible to people's responses to your own work, so that, you know, eyes looking the wrong way or that just kind of response can...
That's a very good point.
You know, it can make you take out those entire things. So because I worked over this, because I had the experience of, you know, losing one publisher and then finding another and then having to kind of... get different responses on the work. Luckily, not too many, but I did have to get them. You know, that probably lengthened the process because I wrote in a couple of different directions according to what people wanted for a little bit of time.
I do agree that that is a danger. Mm. A minor point on the beginning, you said that was always the beginning. Mim is not only in her kitchen, she's putting away knives.
She is.
So... I mean, knives is such a conscious decision. Is that something that was she always putting away knives?
She was always doing something that those first scenes were always her smashing pots and steam and like burning stuff or knives. Yeah. For a long time, there was the second scene was the you know, the washing machine flooding the laundry, and you know, Omni the like Google
so it's a real
Siri
domestic
thing. Yeah.
Sort of
very
but
deeply angry
domestic.
Yeah, deeply angry domestic. And I think, you know, people talk about the rawness of first words, and there was an experience I had recently where I thought that I'd lost, you know, the delights of bloody homeschooling and the people working on different computers, and I thought that I had lost like 6,000 words of the new draft, and I only had 12,000 at that stage. So it was the fear of losing those first words, and I think what is in that scene, and there's a few of them that are like that. The scene where, which I know some people have commented on, the scene where she's remembering her and Nick at the seawall where she licks the wall, that was a first. You know, that was a scene that just came down as is. And I think there is this, I don't know, there's something else. There's some quality in the words of those kind of scenes that you get down that just come out as though you're transcribing them direct from the subconscious that give them a real power. And I think that that's why I always had to start there with knives and banging.
Structurally.
Yep.
Structure's always a real challenge. Do you – so you have a first draft. What's your Michael Haig devotee? What? How do you
– I did all of them. I did everything. Yep. I did Haig. Yep. I did, you know, a couple of times when we were all at Musk, I think Meg Dunley told us this, and it came from Graeme Simsion originally, like every scene on a card and then like ordering all the cards. I looked at it. Thematically, I tried after you had shown me your spreadsheet. I tried a spreadsheet for a while, and then working out, you know, what was happening in each chapter. I tried the snowflake method at some point to get me through. Structurally, I also retyped. I think that's back in season one of us talking about it when I did the whole retyping exercise. And then, but again, that the road trip kept it very nice kind of structurally. It is a chronological, you know, it's a small amount of time. I had to do quite a few timelines to make sure I got things right. And then right at the end, I chucked in, you know, like 10 letters, you know, that were going back between Mim and a grown-up Essie. I think what I was trying to do was to understand some thematic stuff more, and I tried to put it as a rock strata. That's how I kind of worked it out at the end. But it didn't
that
need.
Was, that
yeah.
was the end. That was the visual. Like
that
the
was
structure.
The visual. And I got all these pictures of me kind of going like, these are all the layers of the book and what happens when. And, you know, I think it's like doing anything. It's like putting Haig across the top or any of them. It's just really to validate the decisions that you've made and to understand, okay, this is the plot is working in this way, and this is the kind of structure.
I feel like to understand sometimes a peak that you need to build to a peak.
I mean, one of the things that we worked on a lot and that I continued to work on once I was on board with Fiona at Simon & Schuster was that the complication that I'd thrown in, and maybe the reason that the ending was always kind of not quite there was because that there's such a climactic point on the yacht that the storm on the yacht is such a high point that that it had to go higher than that. And that was quite hard to do. So I, you know, now I understand that that was what happened there. And hopefully that will help me in future books, not take, you know, 17 times to get there, to get it right.
Well, I feel like the 17 times is part of the process.
Yeah, it's so true.
Maybe. Thinking about publication, the book's been in the world 2 months? No, not even. Six weeks?
Yeah.
6 weeks. What's been different this time around?
So
a pandemic. You're
what did the pandemic? Like, so obviously obvious, the not moving with it. And I feel very fortunate that I didn't have the kind of emotional blow of a lot of cancellations just because everything had been in flux kind of since March and my book was always due for September. You know, it wasn't delayed. I didn't have my inbox filled with no, you can't do this anymore. It was just always adapting. So everything was a bonus that I got. So I feel very fortunate for that because it was just not as much an emotional roller coaster. And obviously I was disappointed, but also, you know, I still got to publish my book, you know, and I still got to celebrate it. I think that the ability, and we've talked about this before, for the book industry, the way that they have adapted to do all this kind of online stuff has been incredible. Not only like I've gone to so many events, but I've had the opportunity to still do so many. So that's been great. The flip side is that I suppose now getting to the end of that 6 weeks, is that it's exhausting, but with not with the same level of exhilaration of the energy of the people that you've met, because while it's wonderful to do all the Zoom stuff, it just isn't quite the same as being in the room, of course, with people. And who knows, you know, like I'm not kind of privy enough to trends and all the rest of it to understand the full impact on sales. And, you know, I know that there has been an impact for bookstores and the rest of it, but, you know, comparatively, pandemic aside, I think I was much more prepared this time around, and that's both second time around and of course all the stuff that we've done and the people that we've spoken to. And then I'm also aware of where I sit in the little ecosystem of my book and book world, and understand that when your book comes out, it's about so many more people than just you. And so I think that willingness to go, yep, you know, I will say yes to everything for the period of time that I need to, that I will do all the work, even if it makes me uncomfortable, the social media stuff and the rest of it, I will do all of the things that I can to make this work for that whole infrastructure, all of the people at Simon & Schuster, all of the booksellers. I think just knowing that has made it feel less icky and weird because I understand what the work of it is.
Yeah.
They're the key things. The surprising thing has been being more cognizant of the kids and Adam in a way as well, because I've been at home. So much, I think, normally of my book life is a separate life that I live. I go out at night to book events or, you know, they would never be involved in those types of things. But having them kind of bear witness to it all has been lovely, but it's also been a stress. So it's interesting to think, oh, coming out of this, what is one of the things that I enjoy about the writing life? It's that as anyone enjoys about their work, it's also my separate kind of work.
Mm.
Yeah.
You're living your...
We are, as we all are, living the entire thing.
We always end on a note of advice for other writers. Do you have any?
Why didn't I think about this in advance? That's so silly. You know what? I think that the entire theme of this one really for me has been that advice that that Charlotte gave me about, you know, confidence being a discipline and a practice, and that you really, no one is going to bestow it upon you, that you have to really own it. And I think that's my advice this time around, because for the first time, I did really come crashing down with rejection in this process, and that it was the innate stubbornness, yes, but also confidence in the project, that I had to see the project through to the end, which ultimately allowed me to, you know, to do it and to get it all the way through. So I think confidence, practice it, fake it, and then, you know.
I feel like we need the equivalent of bumper stickers with that on it, but yeah, for walls in,
yeah,
in writing.
To rooms. Flash up, maybe to flash up on our screens, like the moment that we're having the,
right.
Oh, God, I'm not going to do it anymore. You can find the show notes for this episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. If you're feeling so inclined, we would love for you to leave us a review wherever you listen. This helps other people find us.
Get in touch with us via the contact page on our website, or connect with the entire First Time gang on Twitter or Instagram at The First Time Pod. And don't forget, you can support us via Patreon. Go to patreon.com/thefirsttimepodcast. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. We recorded this episode at Kathleen Syme Library on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. The First Time Podcast is produced by Phoebe 80 and supported by Writers Victoria, the ACT Writers Centre, and our wonderful patrons.